I'm Sue Goodwin.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, October 15, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on the Latino vote following last week's election of Donald Trump over Vice President Kamala Harris and what it means to an ever-growing Latino community. And so we're joined on the show today by Arturo Dominguez, freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. As always, welcome back to the show, Arturo Dominguez.
Man, I appreciate it, Oscar. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. And also joining us today is Egberto Willis, who's the host of Politics Done Right, which airs on Pacifica station KPFD in Houston, Texas. He joins us back on the show as well. Welcome back to the show, Egberto Willis.
It's my pleasure to be on the show with both you and Arturo.
I really want to talk to you guys to sort of commiserate and also take a deep dive over what took place last week, because I want to say this right away, right off the bat, that there is no metric in this country that can tell us as to which minority group is more progressive than another, or that one is more conservative than another. It doesn't exist. There is no contest or horse race to prove it. And more importantly, it is irrelevant to the issue at hand. So we can't say that the Latino vote or the Latino community in this country are more conservative or more liberal than other groups. In fact, Latin American history, especially when we've had Arturo on the show, has shown us that Latinos can be just as supportive of authoritarianism as anyone else. But to quote my guest Egberto on his show last week, a deep, hard look in the mirror is necessitated. So with that said, I'll start with you, Egberto. And I'm asking this question to the both of you guys, is that what do you see in the mirror right now? What do you see in the Latino vote? What do you see in this Latino community that led us to Trump being back in office? Egberto.
First of all, as America, what I see in the mirror is embarrassment, disgrace, a country that others will simply respect because of the power they have, the nuclear bombs, the capital, but a country that they have internally no respect for. A country that said you could have accidentally elected Donald Trump because of a constitution that's an aberration, but this time you've elected him not from a constitutional aberration, but from the popular vote. You've elected him with a population that have gone to the right. You've elected him with every demographic sans the Latino women, the black men and black women voting for Donald Trump in a measurable way. So what I see is a disgraced America, without a doubt.
Arturo Dominguez, your response.
I have to agree with that. You know, as a Latino, what I see, I look in the mirror a bit ashamed because Cubans, you know, came out big numbers for Trump. Granted, there's only, you know, about 2.5 million of us in the United States. And, you know, we're not necessarily swinging big elections, but the message that it sends, one, has not been well received. That's for sure, especially by the Black community, by Black women. And in my house where, you know, we're in Texas, we're nowhere near Miami, right? So in my house, we're multiracial. I have, you know, we have multi-generational too. My grandkids running around, my kids, myself, you know, my parents. My stepdad's Jamaican, my sister's Black, my niece and nephew are Black. You know, we all took that pretty hard. And basically, at the end of the day, we feel burned. But when I look at myself in the mirror, being a whitish Cuban, I feel responsible, even though I didn't vote that way. And that, honestly, is a little painful. So
profoundly painful. Yes, right. I agree with you. And I definitely feel that on my part as well, because I think, like both of you guys, I do have people who lean right within my own family who voted for Trump. And it's nothing less than a bitter pill to swallow, you know, considering how my family history as the son of Salvadoran refugees, to think that people within your own family, knowing our own history, that people within your family can vote in this direction. I know it's not something new, it's not unique, but it's still painful nonetheless. And it just leaves me scratching my head because, Arturo, we've had you on the show numerous times, and we've spoken numerous times about the conservative nature in places like Texas and Florida within the Latino community. But this extends beyond Florida and Texas. There are places like Pennsylvania, for example, which has a large Puerto Rican community that saw an increase of support for Donald Trump. So it goes beyond the conventions of conservative Latinos in those states like Texas and Florida. And that's why, as I quoted Egberto, that a real serious look in the mirror needs to be necessitated here as to what direction our community is going. Now, there have been numerous corporate media outlets that have tried to break down the increased Latino support of Donald Trump, and numerous Latinos in these reports have often cited economic uncertainty, the economy, as one of the factors that led to their support of Trump and or the Republican Party as a whole. In fact, a few polls showed that the economy was the number one issue, with other things like the border and migration a distant fourth. This despite all the racist and xenophobic comments and actions by both Trump and the Republican Party, too numerous to mention here. I'm assuming you guys remember the Madison Square Garden rally that happened the week before Election Day, which was, you know, just disgusting to say the least. Despite all that, Latino support for the Republican Party increased. And so my question to you, and I'll start with Arturo this time, have we sort of reached a point in American history where Latinos have become sort of, for lack of a better term, assimilated in American society in the same way as the Irish and Italian immigrants well over a century ago, or at the turn of the 20th century? I've always heard stories that this would happen, but have we reached that point, and are we seeing it now in real time?
You know, I don't know that we're quite there yet, but we're certainly closer than ever, I think, particularly for English-speaking, you know, native U.S.-born, you know, Latinos. I think it might be a little different for the immigrant. I think there's a lot of other things at play when it comes to, you know, race and ethnicity in this country for Latinos, because a lot of us have the accents. A lot of us, you know, we're a mixed-race community. You know, so while me being a white Cuban might be able to get by in white America as a white voter, Egberto, who's Afro-Caribbean and from Panama, probably won't. So I think that for us, it's a little bit more complicated, right? So we're not, like the Irish are all pretty much white, Italians are all Spaniards, same thing. for us, we're just such a mixed bag, from indigenous people to, you know, coming from formerly enslaved people to like Europeans, you know, we're a very mixed bag. So it's a different story for us. I do think psychologically that the psyche of the Latino community has drifted that way more, where they vote more with white people. Because, you know, everybody always tries to make sense of the Latino vote, right? And there's been countless think pieces about we're not a monolith and there's no such thing as the Latino vote. At the end of the day, we're swing voters, you know? And that's, I think that, in my opinion, there is some truth to the economic anxiety that some people were expressing. And I think had Democrats run on a more economic populist message, dare I say Bernie Sanders style, they probably would have had more support from the Latino community. But there were other issues at play as to why Harris lost. And the Latino vote is just one piece of that. As far as whether we're assimilated or not, I don't think we're there yet. As I said at the beginning, I think we are closer than ever.
Egberto Willis, your response.
Let me, first of all, I want to thank Arturo for something that people refuse to understand about the Latino community. The Latino word is an American throwaway word. It only means these people south of the border. That's all it means to Americans, because people south of the border, a Brazilian is a Latino. Most Brazilians, even though not acknowledged all the times, are black or high percentage black. Panama, Costa Rica, Honduras, all these other places, right? Large, substantial population of both indigenous and black people. When they look and they say, when they talk about 90, I forgot what the new number is, 1930 something. That's the time that white people become the minority. I always laugh at that, right? Because the truth of the matter is white people will never become a minority in the United States, because even as they look at a growing Latino population, the growing population of Latino means a lot more white people as well. And as a lot of Latinos show you right now, is they do what every other culture does, and that is closeness to whiteness. Okay, and whiteness, it's interesting, because whereas we think of closeness to whiteness as pigmentation, etc., it is a lot more complicated. After all, my sister is a Trump supporter. So my older sister, let me specify that, and specify it dearly. So it is great that Arturo brought up the race issue in the Latino community, because the Latino community has a lot of that. If you watch TikTok right now, you'll see a lot of Afro-Panamanians, Afro-Dominicans, and Afro-Saint, it wasn't me, right? Because they wanted to point out that we know we won't ever be the ones that Trump say it's okay. Now, the only thing that I question a lot is, I don't like us to dwell on the economic issue, because for one who studies economics a lot, ones who follow the numbers a lot, there are several things to note here. The economy that Biden received was a crashed economy. And the economy that he is handing over to now President Trump is an economy much better than the economy he received. That's a statement of fact that can be shown. They can talk about inflation, they can talk about all these things, but these are things that were initiated from, first of all, Trump mishandling a pandemic that shouldn't be as bad to the American population and shouldn't have stopped the problem. So all in all, we could even blame all the economic issues that Biden had to fix that is now fixed on Trump. Now, Biden has a lot of problems. We have capitalism is a killer.
Yes.
Okay, capitalism is horrendous. But Biden didn't create capitalism, and Biden didn't make the United States a capitalist country. What we needed to do with Biden and Kamala is pretty much say, you know, they can call themselves a capitalist as much as they want. It is the responsibility of us activists to point out and to start in primaries getting rid of that. But I hate when we use the economy, because the facts simply don't bore out, and we don't have the mainstream media telling the Americans the truth. And all it's doing is giving them an excuse to let their sexist, racist xenophobia play out. It gives them an excuse to be xenophobic and racist and sexist without having to admit it. Hey, no, that's not the reason. This is the reason. The reason Kamala isn't president is because she doesn't have a penis and because she's not white.
I'll say this with regards to the economy here, is that whether the economy was perfect or problematic, as people say it is right now, I would not mortgage my humanity for the sake of extra bucks in my paycheck, considering what we saw in the first Trump administration, because this goes beyond just Harris and Trump, the individuals. When we go to the polls and elect somebody, we're not just electing that individual, we're electing all the people that come along with that individual.
Yes.
And Arturo, you mentioned before we started recording today, the name Eric Holman. And this is, at the very least, a microcosm of some of the things that are coming down the pike now that Trump is back in office. So please enlighten us, if you can, Arturo, about him and what this means to migrants, not just Latino migrants. Certainly African and Haitian migrants are going to suffer as well. Anyone seeking asylum, anyone who has last names such as myself and Arturo and Egberto are just going to be seen at as now targets of whatever policy they have in mind.
So I believe it's Tom Holman, but yeah, he was border czar or whatever you want to call it under Obama, right? He's Mr. Loophole, right? He made Obama deporter in chief. He's the one that figured out how to deport people at a large scale. I wouldn't say mass, but it was pretty damn close. As soon as I hear his name, it brings me back to the T. Don Hutto facility in Taylor, Texas, where I protested when Obama was in office because of sexual assaults that were going on in that place. And I lived about 3 miles away. So, you know, it's not, I could just ignore it. It's out in the middle of nowhere. I lived out in the middle of nowhere at the time. And it brings me back to a lot of horrifying stuff that happened under Obama. The ICE raids, kicking people's doors down, those were violent. I mean, we're talking about guys with military-style rifles, full gear, night vision. I mean, they look like special forces guys kicking in apartment doors and businesses and all over the place. And while there was a lot of issues with the separation of families, detaining children, all that went to court. We ended up with the Flores settlement, all those things that you can't detain kids for so long. You know, there's limits to that. It was a pretty violent time. And Holman has been salivating to be the mass deporter. He is one of the authors and architects of Project 2025 and the immigration policies in that, which are pretty violent. And he was recently asked in an interview, I believe it was 60 Minutes, how is family separation going to be an issue? And something like that. And his response was something along the lines of, there's a simple solution to that, deport the whole family. There's obvious problems with that, right? So my parents are immigrants. My step-parents are immigrants. I was born in this country before my mom was a citizen, right? So when these guys are talking about denaturalizing people, and if they take my mom's citizenship away, and then they try to take my birthright citizenship away, and my brother's birthright citizenship away, who voted for Trump, by the way, both of them, all of us might get our asses deported to Cuba. What the hell do we know about Cuba? My mom hasn't been there in 50 years. You know, I did grow up there. I don't know, you know, I know from family that come and go and things like that. So it's not that we haven't thought of these things in this house. We have. But to people like my brothers, no, not us. We're not criminals, right? We hear this constantly. With a guy like Tom Holman, it does not matter.
Exactly.
The guy, he's a horrifying person.
Exactly. And therein lies the problem, is that if birthright citizenship doesn't give you the right to be in this country, where does the line end? How far down your family line will this administration go to deport people? It's insane. And I'm glad that you bring up that subject, because people who supported for Trump, especially Latino males, should listen to that and think about that when they voted for him. I want to go back to Egberto, because he mentioned something very important, which is the issue of sexism in this country. Now, sexism or machismo, whatever term you want to use, is not exclusive to Latinos. It's not exclusive to this country. It's not exclusive to this region as well. I mean, we could call on countless examples of sexism throughout all of Latin America and the Caribbean. But what I realized is that it seems like Latin America and the Caribbean has been far more prepared for a female president than the United States. As we have this conversation now, Mexico just elected its first female president. Several years ago, Costa Rica elected its first Afro-Latina president, Epsi Campbell Barr. And even right now, the current vice president of Colombia is an Afro-Latina woman. And so I guess my question to you here is, how do we balance, yes, the reality of sexism with the fact that it seems like the United States is less prepared for a female leader than in other parts of the region? I think this is a lot more important of an issue than people realize.
Latin America has an interesting way of dealing with sexism, racism, etc. They exist, but they are so, I don't know what's the word to use, but it's not denying. In other words, in countries like Panama, I don't know if you remember in South Africa, when black folks go over to South Africa, the dignitaries, they had to be declared honorary whites to be able to stay in certain places, etc. Right? Really? Because the laws, the way the laws are written, your pigmentation determined where you could be. So you had to be declared an honorary something to be able to go in there. Well, in Latin America, we have a lot of honorary many things. You know, I mean, and the way it works, I mean, I hadn't noticed this until I came to the States and realized how we talk about people of different races and ethnicities, the way we talk about Chinese, the way we talk about black people in Panama, and we call them the chumbo, el negro, and all of that. And even you listen to our salsa, right? We just celebrated a huge Panamanian gala on Saturday. And I, you know, as an activist now, I'm listening to our music. And I'm like, my God, if that music was in English, we would be in trouble, you know? So, I mean, and it's an intermingling of color and sexism and at the same, I mean, it is amazing. I'm not saying it's good, but the results you can see, yes, Mexico has a female president, right? And it wasn't even that hard. Costa Rica got themselves the black vice president of Caribbean descent from Limon. It wasn't all that hard. Same thing happened with Colombia, and we can go on and on and on, and women being leaders. And to tell it bluntly, they've shown to be better leaders. We look at New Zealand and how they handled the COVID epidemic. You know, there's sexism there, but it's a part of a fabric that isn't terminal. In America, it is terminal. And it has been proven to be terminal in how we, I think our power taught us that we didn't really have to evolve. And while we can evolve in words, in deeds, we never evolve. Not to take any more, too much of your time, but I just want to give an example. You know, all of us hate what's happening to the Palestinians, and we want America to stop bombing. We want America to stop doing all these things. But why would America stop doing that when that is the same thing America perpetrates? In Panama, they kill thousands of Panamanians because they wanted to get Manuel Antonio Noriega. Really? And what they did is they flattened Marañón, they flattened parts of Colón, where I'm from, to get one guy. Same thing that Israel is doing. Why would we stop Israel from doing that?
Oh my goodness. I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that's sort of a segue to my next question. And this is directly to you, Egberto, since you're originally from Panama, is that following, you know, my previous question, is there a disconnect between Latinos born in the U.S. with recent migrants? And I ask you this not just in politics, not just in language, but also in our understanding of the broader world, and dare I say, in education. Because you have that, the U.S. invasion of Panama in 89, as a very crucial frame of reference, I would imagine, to the work that you do at KPFD as well.
Absolutely. So if there's a difference, we just had a big picnic yesterday, and we had a lot of Latinos over, Panamanians. We had people from Honduras. We had Costa Ricans. We had Mexicans. We had everybody. And probably half of them were born from immigrants. Some of them were second-generation immigrants. And I thought we all broke bread well together. I think it has, and I think Arturo nails this in a lot of his writings, right? Arturo writes a lot about Latinidad and closeness to whiteness and all of that. I think that is really the issue in the Latin community. Not that we have different values, but that we have those who want to approach that whiteness. And that doesn't only, believe it or not, don't only happen with Latinos. It also happens with Black people. And it's hard to believe that. I got a text today from a friend of mine who castigated Black women for being excited that Kamala Harris could have been president. And he said, you messed with white sensibilities by talking about that out loud. It's your fault that she lost. Once again, no, it's not her fault that she lost. It's the fault of all those women who thought whiteness was more important than their own bodies. Those Latino men, all of those who thought that. But even Black people have the same disease. Black Latinos, they all have the same disease.
And it goes back to what I said earlier, is that Latin American history has shown numerous times, and even in recent history, that Latinos can be just as supportive of authoritarianism as anyone else. We've heard the idea of the pink tide in Latin America, and it's gone back and forth numerous times in the last 24 years alone. So it's a crucial frame of reference in understanding the Latino vote here in the U.S., but it doesn't make, you know, what took place here any less disappointing. And so this is why we're breaking down and giving a more nuanced conversation to what took place this month during the elections. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. And we're also speaking with Egberto Willis, who's the host of Politics Done Right, which airs on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. That was Rita, Indiana, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we are breaking down and demystifying the Latino vote with Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas, and Egberto Willis, who's the host of Politics Done Right, which airs on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas. So before I continue my line of questioning here, I want to take this opportunity to give you guys the opportunity to, like, 2 or 3 minutes sort of point out some intangible things about the Latino vote or the vote within the Latino community, some issues or something intangible that corporate media may have missed altogether. I have to say that Arturo, considering the numerous conversations we've had over the years with regards to fake news and misinformation, you've documented this several times about hate speech and hate talk radio, AM radio, within the Latino community and Spanish-speaking Latino media. It seems like it's gotten worse, but I don't want to lead the witness here. I want to see if you could tell me some other issue or something intangible here that sort of led us to the Latino vote going in Trump's direction. Is there something else here that we may have missed?
You know, I think for the Latino vote, and we talked about the machismo and all that, you know, the combination of racism and misogyny is what we call misogyny noir. And Latinos trying to exploit their proximity to whiteness is arguably why this country is still behind countries like Mexico and some of the other ones we mentioned. There's a uniqueness to white supremacy in this country, whereas in Latin America, white supremacy exists more on a systemic level. You see it on the street and stuff like that, but you don't see the existence of hate groups like the KKK, the Proud Boys, and the whole manosphere culture, right, that's online right now. The whole put men first, we should have never gave women the right to vote, repeal the 19th Amendment, the whole trad wife thing, traditional wife thing, that's a white Christian nationalist thing. All that stuff bleeds into our communities. So the more mainstream it becomes, the more it infects a lot of the machismo in our communities. So when you're looking at misogyny noir coming from the Latino community, of course you're going to see it from Latino men, right? Latino men came out for Trump in much bigger numbers than Latinas did. And that's the reason. Maybe some Latinas were a little bit racist, but I don't think they held being a woman against her. For Latino men, I think that was an issue. And they bought into a lot of what the Steve Bannons, the Donald Trumps, the Stephen Millers, the Tony Hinchcliffe with the Puerto Ricans are trash. Yeah, they buy into that, that stuff. And there's always the mentality of they're not talking about me, they're talking about them. And whoever them may be, to a Puerto Rican, it might be they're talking about Mexicans. To Mexicans, it might be they're not talking about me, they're talking about criminals. To Cubans, it's they're talking about criminals, they're talking about all them brown Mexicans, not us white ones. So Latinidad is complicated as hell. It's not as simple as just black and white. It's not just white supremacy. And racial understandings in this country are black and white. For the most part, they're black and white. So the general population doesn't understand these little nuanced things, but we see them. You, me, Alberto, even the misogynistic Latino men, they see it, they know it, but they're still that way. And I think a lot of what people are missing is in all that mess that I just described. Because to people who are just first time being exposed to this, what I just described is a mess. For us, we understand it without words. But trying to understand it from the outside is much more complicated. And I think Democrats miss that.
Oh, yeah. Democrats miss that profoundly. The last time we had you on the show, we sort of pointed that out during the Univision town halls. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I still have that clip of Kamala Harris bragging about the Republican support that she had, which to me was nothing short of catastrophic to even do that. So before I go to Egberto, let me play that clip. And this is Kamala Harris responding to Republican support on Univision's town hall. Let's take a listen.
I am honored to have earned the Democratic nomination. I am honored to have the endorsement of people from every walk of life. You will probably find that I probably have a bigger coalition of people who couldn't seem to be more different than each other, who have come together around my candidacy. From 200 Republicans who worked with and for both Presidents Bush, John McCain, Mitt Romney, including Liz Cheney, the former congresswoman, and her father, the former vice president, Dick Cheney, who was supporting me. Former members, very esteemed members, including generals of the national security community. I have the endorsement and support of Alberto Gonzalez, most recently, who of course was attorney general. I have the support of people from every background, and I believe this is the reason why.
So that was Kamala Harris bringing about Republican support in one of Univision's town halls last month. And she just mentioned there, people can't see us, but me and Arturo are shaking our heads here. She just mentioned a who's who of people who pushed for the war in Iraq over 20 years ago, and a who's who of people who pushed anti-immigration laws in places like Arizona and Texas and Mississippi long before Trump came into national prominence in the way that he has. And so with that said, though, I want to go to Egberto here and sort of ask the same question I asked Arturo here, which is, you know, what other intangibles do you feel people may have missed in explaining, you know, why Latinos voted the way they did? There's a litany of things, but is there anything that you feel that people may have missed here?
Let me first address her comments, because I think I was a bit naive about that, because my contention is that not everybody is as politically aware as El Señor Oscar and Arturo. And my contention was, even though I hate all those people that now support her, my spin was, my God, if these people support this woman, that really means that Donald Trump is an existential threat. I didn't think like you and Arturo. I thought that just maybe that the way that would have been taken by the community would be that, well, hell, if even these crazies don't support Trump, then we definitely can't. It's evident both of you knew more than I did in that regards, because the truth of the matter is, I'm sorry, I hate those guys as much as you guys, not when I say you guys understand what I'm saying, just as much as you guys do. But I thought, even though I always say if you can go for Republican, why buy Republican light? That's something that I talk about all the time, right?
Yes.
But in this case, I really, and again, I went on my KPFT show and said how wrong I was in some of the things that I didn't push back on, because I thought it was some way to get to others. Boy, was I wrong. Now, that said, I want to give you an example of something that really hit me and kind of illustrated to me later on how wrong we can go with this Latino vote. There was an interview on MSNBC, and it turns out that it was an Honduran man, a Mexican woman married to each other. I may have the reverse, but married together. The man voted for Kamala, but really, really deep in his heart wanted a Trump. But he could, you know, there's some gravity to who you vote for.
I know which story you're talking about, but please continue. I saw this.
Right. And then there was the woman who was, I think is Honduran, who voted for Trump, and her son voted for Trump. And the husband said he felt okay that those two voted for Trump. But the zinger that got me was, I didn't know that they came over to the United States illegally. They are the definition of crossing the border past the river. Okay? That's what they did. And when the guy asked them, how did you get here? We got here illegally. And why is it then that you believe that those people that are coming now should get a different treatment than you do? Well, they're criminals. And I want to expand on that. They don't see themselves as the criminals coming over, but the other Latinos that are coming over now, by the way, not much different in makeup than it was at the time that they were crossing. They are criminals. And when we talk about the AM and the nastiness that's happening on AM, what did the Democrats miss? The Democrats are thieves of the people who donate to them, to their monies, okay? Kamala got $1 something billion. All that money went to tacticians, analysts, and all these kind of folks that know absolutely nothing about the middle class, the poor, Latinos, or anything in between. They're the ones giving her advice. They're the ones, instead, if we had that $1.2 billion and gave Arturo Dominguez some more money to write and expand on his message, if we gave that money to, and by the way, it wouldn't have cost him all that much, because, you know, Arturo, we work for cheap, man.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
We work for cheap. You know? If you went ahead and invest that money in blogs and radio, look, That's what Trump did. Trump spent $300-something million. She spent $1.2 billion. And all that money went to those high-priced guys, $10,000 a pop, $20,000. Hey, give me $10,000. I would be the best essay writer for you going forward. But the thing about it is, I don't even think it is that they don't see. I think it's that they don't give a damn. These people don't care who really win. They're going to do fine whether Trump wins or Harris wins. But that $1.2 billion that they're begging the poor people that are giving them every day, give us a dollar here, give us $3 here, give us $5 here. It adds up. Guess what? To $1 point something billion. And I am on Substack trying to make a penny. Brother Arturo is on Substack trying to make a penny. And instead of saying, you know what? There are these great writers there. Let's go ahead and help the Latino community be informed. Even on AM radio, Black AM radio, Latino AM radio, we can do all of that. None of that was done in the form that it should have been.
Yeah, the issue of the political consultant class is a conversation in and of itself that's catastrophic to the entire country, not just the Latino community. But that story that you mentioned, Egberto, really makes me sad, because at the end of the day, this incoming Trump administration will not make any distinction as to whether or not they were Trump supporters or not. Mm-hmm. They're just going to see their names, their language, their accent, their country and origin, and make a punitive decision right there. Mm-hmm. And that's the irony of that particular story, is that this party that they voted for makes no distinction between a Salvadoran, between a Cuban, between a Panamanian. It's all Latinos, and it's all people worthy of being deported. End of story.
Believe it or not, I do think that by them, you know, people say, well, oh, they sold themselves on national TV. Now the migra knows where to go. No, now the migra knows not where to go, because they will be safe, because they're the spokespersons for the lie, right? They're the spokesperson for the lie now. So they will be safe. They'll be used as the right kind of Latino, even though they came over here illegally, right? Supposedly illegally. I don't like to use that term, but they'll be the example. But the people that other will look like them, c'est la vie.
C'est la vie, exactly. So another issue I want to address here is that, generally speaking, this election result leads me to believe that a lot of people in this country do not care about women's rights and LGBTQ rights. Mm-hmm. And I put those two issues together because oftentimes the people that push to roll back women's rights are the same ones that are rolling back LGBTQ rights. They're one in the same. And this election cycle saw some of the most heinous rhetoric against LGBTQ rights that I have ever seen. Oh my goodness, here in Washington alone, there were some political rads running on television that were just plain old offensive of trans people that I am too embarrassed to even describe here on the air. But what does the Latino vote tell us about the importance of women's reproductive rights and LGBTQ rights within our community? And I ask this, Arturo, because I'm Salvadoran. I've seen what El Salvador does with regards to reproductive rights for women and LGBTQ rights. For me, it's nothing short of barbaric, punitive, and in the Stone Age, how they treat women in El Salvador. And that's just a small microcosm there, but this is a component within the Latino community, which I said at the beginning, we need to have a long, deep look in the mirror about.
Again, we come back to that machismo, right? So women's rights aren't as important to Latino men. And then we have to talk about the homophobia and the transphobia too, because I think one of the issues where Democrats made the mistake, especially on the quote-unquote boys and girls sports, first let me start by saying that's transphobic, saying boys and girls sports. They're not boys, first. And secondly, it's not really an issue to the vast majority of Americans. The number of trans people in this country is so small that it doesn't impact most Americans, the vast majority of Americans. Where Democrats failed is they took the bait. They took the bait on a lot of issues, immigration, policing, the trans issue was the worst. When Ted Cruz was running ads against All Red here in Texas about immigration, he was getting roasted by Republicans and Democrats all over the state because of the quote-unquote bipartisan border bill and how he didn't vote for it, how it didn't pass because of Republicans. So he switched strategies. He dropped the border talk, went to trans issues, started accusing Colin Allred of saying he wanted boys to play in girls' sports. First of all, Allred never said that. Secondly, Allred responded to that ad by saying, I never said that, and I'm a Christian man, you know, and he was trying to appeal to the Christian nationalist in Texas, a black man. No, dude, no. First of all, the Christian nationalists are not going to vote for you. Conservatives are not going to vote for somebody with a D next to their name. Stop trying to appeal to them, okay, period. They are not going to vote for you. Shifting to the right, across the board for Democrats was a huge deal breaker for a lot of people. It crushed them on a lot of issues. Immigration, like I said, policing, and then the trans issue. The trans issue for me is particularly personal because not many people know this, but I am the father of a trans adult. I raised a trans child. I raised a gay child and I raised a straight cis child. My trans kid is at risk. I don't talk about my trans kid because I'm already a target. I'm not trying to put a bullseye on them too. But enough is enough. Colin Allred dropped the ball on the trans issue. In 2020, Biden ran on the progressive platform, and one of those issues was trans rights or human rights. Every time Kamala Harris was asked about trans rights, she could not and would not say that. She just kept falling back to, we're gonna do what Donald Trump did. We're gonna follow the law. What law are you talking about? What law are you talking about? Trans people are people. They are deserving of every right you and I have. If they have to go piss, let them go pee wherever they gotta go. It doesn't matter. They're not a threat to your children. White Christian men, youth pastors are a threat to your children. Police are a threat to your children. Customs and Border Patrol are a threat to children. They rape and beat women constantly. Children too. And you are worried about a tenth of a percent of people? You let Republicans run the table on the trans issue and you fell for it. And that is what hurt.
Egberto, before I get your response, I just want to say here that in the coming weeks ahead, we are going to do an episode exclusively on what this new administration, this new Trump administration, will mean for LGBTQ rights in the United States. With that said, Egberto, your response?
Yeah, first of all, I want to say that I find that Arturo's narrative to be the perfect narrative that we need to start teaching Democrats. Yes, I've been saying to myself for a long time, don't move right, but his is so perfectly illustrated. I want to add an addendum to that. When they hit trans going to the bathroom, you know, the same way they attack trans and they use specific incidents to show one incident that occurred or whatever, we need to show pastors being a danger to your kid in ads graphically attacking the pastors directly and start making people see where the real dangers are. I like Arturo's way of saying Democrats need to go more in your face. And as he mentioned before in the statement, not take the bait, which is what they've done, taking the bait. So I want to say something else because, you know, we have a lot of folks that talk here on radio, et cetera. And I just want to give our brother here some kudos. I don't remember how I got into this particular issue, but we talk about women's issues all of the times. I watched him with a group of black women authors not take positions specifically saying, this is your space. So the man puts his money where his mouth, or put his actions where his mouth speaketh.
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, like I said before, we're gonna dedicate an entire hour in the coming weeks ahead to this particular subject, especially within the Latino community, because there is, as Arturo has shown here, there is a large LGBTQ community within the Latino community that deserves a one-hour nuanced conversation in and of itself. We have about 4 minutes left. And one of the deal breakers for me, as far as people turning away from the Democratic Party and seeing the results unfold the way it did, is Gaza. Yeah. I don't think we could have this conversation today without mentioning Gaza. I don't think we could have this conversation today without acknowledging our Arab brothers and sisters, their own community, and the actions that they took with regards to their vote, especially with everything that's happened in the last year alone. If you recall, in November of last year, that a newspaper in Michigan, an Arab American newspaper, sort of in the same vein as the Pacifica Network, said that, hey, Biden just lost the Arab vote. And this month proved that. And so long as the carnage and inhumanity in Gaza continues, that's certainly the case. And probably justification, for lack of a better word, as to why people did not vote for Harris. So I want to get a 1 minute take from each and every one of you, since running out of time, and give us your thoughts on the importance of Gaza with regards to the vote that we saw this month. Arturo.
Man, the whole thing about Gaza is, and again, this is part of Democrats' shift to the right too. They thought they could make up the lost votes in Michigan and elsewhere and across various issues by trying to pick up conservative voters. Their mistake was ignoring Michigan. This is Hillary Clinton all over again, 2016. Ignore Michigan and you will pay. I don't know what was so hard for Kamala Harris to say that this started before October 7th. She needed to stop saying October 7th 50 times every time somebody asked a question. Nobody wants to hear that because everybody knows that this has been going on for 75 years. We all know about the Balfour Declaration. We all know the history. Social media made everybody very well aware of that over the last year. Why she continued to say this started on October 7th was a deal breaker for a lot of people. And I believe that that single issue is why you had a much lower turnout for her than you did for Joe Biden.
Egberto Willis.
I hate the Gaza issue. The Gaza issue is not, for me, a Kamala Harris problem or a Kamala Harris problem or a Joe Biden problem or a Reagan problem. It's an AIPAC problem and the likes. Politicians are fearful of AIPAC and they are owned by AIPAC. And if Kamala says anything that is AIPAC-like, I just thought that was a losing proposition. I don't know how to handle it. It's above my pay grade. I know that she was doomed if she did and doomed if she didn't. And just maybe some politician would try to be doomed doing the right thing and then suddenly winning for doing the right thing. Maybe it'll happen sometime, but so far it hasn't.
And I'll also point out that we just did a show several weeks ago about Latin American solidarity with the people of Palestine, not just Gaza, with the people of Palestine, because of what Arturo mentioned, is that people have a much greater understanding of this 76-year history with regards to the Nakba and this occupation and this apartheid system that's been supported by both political parties here in the United States. So this has been a very intense, complex, nuanced, but important conversation that we've had today on the show here. So we've been speaking with Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. Arturo, as always, it's fun, it's enlightening, it's informative, and it's been very intense today. But nonetheless, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Man, I'm really happy to be here. This was a much needed and important conversation. And I hope people can take something away from it.
Absolutely. We've also been joined today by Egberto Willis, who's the host of Politics Done Right, which airs on Pacifica Station KPFD in Houston, Texas. He also has a YouTube channel of the same name. Egberto, I want to have more conversations like this with you in the future. But in the meantime, thank you for being on the show with us today.
Thank you so kindly. It's been an honor for me to be on your show at any time, and I hope you'll give me the honor of coming to my show as well, Oscar, because I tell you, we need to have a whole lot more discussions like this, and we need to really promote these as widely as possible.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for being on the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, November 15th. Here are some headlines. President-elect Trump said yesterday he'll nominate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be Health and Human Services Secretary, putting the prominent vaccine skeptic in charge of the FDA, the CDC, and almost 25% of the federal budget. Kennedy has made claims that he will drastically reduce rates of chronic disease in just 2 years. He has spread several conspiracy theories, including claims that Wi-Fi causes cancer and school shootings are caused by antidepressants. It's yet another of several highly controversial nominations that include Matt Gaetz for Attorney General and Doug Burgum to lead the Department of the Interior, a position that gives the North Dakota governor significant influence over the new administration's plans to open federal lands and waters to oil and gas drilling. Governor Burgum has longstanding ties to fossil fuel companies and acted as a liaison between the Trump campaign and the oil executives who donated heavily to it. But it is the nomination of Matt Gaetz as Attorney General that is gaining most of the attention and controversy. He was the subject of an ongoing ethics investigation in the House of Representatives into allegations of sexual misconduct, illicit drug use, and misuse of campaign funds. But on Wednesday evening, reportedly just 2 days before the release of a critical House report on the investigation, Gaetz resigned his position in Congress, effectively ending the House probe, since the committee only investigates current members. Yesterday, top Senate Democrat Dick Durbin asked the House committee to preserve and share the findings of that report, saying the sequence and timing of the resignation raised questions. It remains unclear if and when the report will be released. In other news, aid access in Gaza is at a low point, with deliveries to parts of the besieged north of the enclave all but impossible, a UN humanitarian official said today. In response to a question at a Geneva press conference about whether humanitarian access had improved, a spokesperson for the UN Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said, quote, "From our perspective, on all indicators you can possibly think of in a humanitarian response, all of them are going in the wrong direction," close quote. The remarks run counter to a U.S. assessment earlier this week that Israel is not currently impeding humanitarian aid for the Gaza Strip, avoiding restrictions on U.S. military aid. And 21 defense rescuers have been killed in 2 Israeli strikes on Lebanon last night, marking one of the deadliest days for rescue workers since the fighting began between Israel and Hezbollah 13 months ago. The airstrikes brought the total number of emergency workers killed by Israel in Lebanon to more than 200, most of them during the last 2 months. After 13 months of war, more than 3,300 people have been killed and more than 14,400 wounded, Lebanon's health ministry has said. The ministry condemned last night's strikes and called on the international community, quote, to put an end to these dangerous violations, close quote. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodman.